Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is the Best Ever You Show, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Hamilton-Garino, and Katie is off again today. So, Karen Walrond, it's going to be you and me hosting the show today.
Fantastic.
It's our own little show. Maybe we should answer all of these calls. we can say, welcome to the Best Ever You Show. What would you like? Anyway, I'm so happy to have you as a guest, and thank you so much for joining us for this hour.
It's my honor to be here.
Yeah, I'm tickled to have you. You're the author and of The Beauty of Different, which has grown to be one of our favorite books, and the tagline of it is Observations of a Confident Misfit. I'm dying
Correct.
To know how you came up with that title. We'll come back to it in a minute, but just thank you for being here. You're a lawyer, and goodness gracious, could you have a bigger resume?
I think it means that I don't know what I want to be when I grow up.
No, I think you've got it pretty handled there. Before we go on, I wanted to direct people to your websites, because frequently when people are listening to our show, they're on the computer also. And so if they want to look at some of the things that you've done also, they can go to, I'm going to destroy it again, Chukalunks.
You got it.
And that's spelled Chookalounks. .com. They can go to KarenWalrond.com, and they can go to TheBeautyOfDifferent.com, correct?
Absolutely. That's it.
Okay, so do all those places go to the same website? Or
pretty much, yeah. At least they may land on different places, but you're pretty much there if you get any of those right.
Okay. All right. Well, what would you like to talk about first? I know I said before we went on the air that I wanted to know just really early on, like, who you are as a person, like where you grew up and all that stuff. Do you want to go there first?
Sure, absolutely.
I would love to hear who you are.
So I was born in the late 60s in a small country called Trinidad and Tobago, two islands, one country, in the Caribbean, just off the coast of Venezuela in South America. So I was born there. My dad, I'm Trini, my parents are Trini, my whole family's Trini pretty much, and my dad was a petroleum engineer. Trinidad actually has a huge, its main industry is oil and gas, is energy. And so my dad was a petroleum engineer. My mother was a teacher. Her superpower is languages, actually. She obviously speaks English, and then she studied Spanish and French, and she speaks Norwegian and a little Russian, and she's amazing. Anyway, so she taught Spanish. At first, and French, I think, in Trinidad. And so I was born there. And it's sort of interesting because we moved like a year after I was born to Pennsylvania. My dad went to get his master's and PhD at Penn State University. Mm-hmm. So we moved there. And then when I was five, or actually when I was about four, we moved to Texas. Mm-hmm. And then when I was five, we moved back to Trinidad. And really, my whole childhood was kind of moving back and forth between Trinidad and Texas.
Pretty much
the entire time, yeah. So I sort of feel like I feel very Trini. I grew up in a Trini house. And when I'm in Trinidad, that's when I feel most home. Like, that feels like home. But Texas is clearly my adopted home. So I've been living in Texas for a long time now, since college. And so that's kind of how it started.
So for me, for example, I was born in Minnesota, and I've never been able yet to leave the United States. I've been pretty much to most of the states and so forth. But to someone like me who hasn't been out of the United States, which I'm sure they're floating around, people just like me, what is Trinidad like? What's that like to grow up there? What's your house look like? What's your, you know, what kind of school do you go? You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah,
what are
Trinidad.
Some images that you could...
So Trinidad is... if you think of the Caribbean, if you think of like the line of islands that make up the Caribbean, Trinidad is actually the very, very last one. So like if you start with Cuba and kind of follow the line of islands all the way down, very, very last one. It's 9 miles off the coast of Venezuela. On a clear day, you can actually see Venezuela. It's two islands, like I said, Trinidad and Tobago. Trinidad is the bigger of the two islands. It's about 60 by 90 miles, kind of. So it's tiny. And it, unlike a lot of, like, when you think of the Caribbean, a lot of people think of, you know, beautiful powdery beaches and beautiful blue water, and that's actually not Trinidad. Trinidad, they've got a couple of good beaches. Tobago's got great beaches, but Trinidad doesn't have a lot of good beaches. The water is not as that crystalline kind of blue, but it's a beautiful place. It's very lush, lots of rainforest. It's very, very, you know, if you think rainforest and jungle and hills and things like that, that's definitely Trinidad.
Beautiful.
It's lovely. It's temperate, so there's no seasons. There's just kind of rainy season and dry season.
Yeah.
And, in around wintertime, around American wintertime, it's probably high 80s, I guess, maybe. Low 60s. Yeah, and then in the summertime, it gets hotter. It gets to about mid-90s, and then lows in the 70s. But it really doesn't get change in temperature very much. And it's beautiful. It, you know, there's always sea breezes because it's small. So even though there's certainly humidity, trust me, it's nothing like Houston humidity, which I deal with every year here. Summers cripple me.
I've been to Texas a few times, and every time I've been there, I thought the Midwest was pretty humid, but that is humid.
Yes,
it's
much more humid in Houston than it is in Trinidad. So so the people are kind of there's a mixture of races that are in Trinidad. It's primarily sort of South Asian, so if you think like Indian, Pakistani sort of derivation, and then there's black, and then there's Chinese and white and you know, Middle Eastern, stuff like that. And unlike a lot of the other other islands in Trinidad, everybody married everybody, so everybody's very mixed, right? So so like my father's half Chinese, my mother's half Indian, more or less, and so it's a very, very incredibly multiracial country, but in a real, like I said, you know, you can't really identify what people are. Like, you know, like it's not segregated at all. Everybody's very, very mixed. And of course, that means that there's a lot of, the religions are different. Like you get national holidays for Christmas, but you also get it for Diwali, and you get it for Eid, you know, Muslim holidays and the Hindu. So it's very, very multi-ethnic and multicultural. The music that we play at Christmas time is called Parang, and it's very Spanish. It sounds like South America. And so there's a lot of that kind of mixing. The foods are a lot of Indian influence in the food, a lot of Creole. So it's really a multiracial place. And I love it. It is also one of the wealthiest, because of the oil and gas, it's one of the wealthiest islands in the Caribbean. So it's very modern. So, I mean, you know, if you went to Trinidad, you'd see skyscrapers and high-rises and, you know, I mean, the same sort of thing that you would see in the United States. But it's definitely got its own flavor. So it's a lovely place. I miss it a lot.
So how do you is that the source of a lot of your inspiration for some of the things that you do? Or does it come from just life and living, or your parents, or your mom, or your dad? Or, you know, this book is just amazing.
The book, The Beauty of Different.
Yeah, your book, The Beauty of Different, Observations of a Confident Misfit. And I love our theory on life is kind of the same, where, you know, everybody is so amazing, and everybody has something to contribute, and everybody is beautiful in their own way. That's what I love about living, too, because you come across people who can, you know, one person can sew really well and another person can cook really well, and every once in a while you come across someone who can sew and cook perfectly, and everybody's so different.
Sure.
And where did you get that from, that line of thinking?
I think a lot of it actually had a lot to do with the fact that we moved around so much, that we moved from Trinidad to the United States so often. And so, you know, I had sort of a hybrid upbringing, right? Like, I mean, at home, definitely it was Trinidad, right? My parents raised me as a Trini, and I feel, like I said, culturally, I feel most aligned with being in Trinidad. I moved back to Trinidad as an adult, and I actually was a little concerned that I would have some sort of culture shock because I'd been in the United States for so long, and I totally didn't. I came right back in, my Trini accent came right back, everything, you know, just really kind of went back in. It's definitely home for me. But growing up, I you know, it was about every 2 years or so we moved. Every 2 years we'd go from Trinidad to Houston primarily, and then Trinidad and then back to Houston. And I never fit in, right? Because on one hand, I would come to the United States and I had sort of an accent, and of course my background and my culture wasn't African American, so I didn't fit in really anywhere in America. Mm-hmm. And then I would go back to Trinidad, and I'd have an American accent, right? The schooling is very different. You know, there's uniforms that I had to wear. Public schooling is very different, and I was sort of an oddity in Trinidad as well. So. I kind of grew up sort of balancing that I'm not fitting in anywhere because we moved as often as we did.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny because I think about, you know, friends of mine who move just anywhere, like change cities, let alone change countries, with teenagers. And, you know, they're always very concerned about, you know, how is your teenager going to deal with it, and is it going to be difficult? And sure, I think it is. But I think in a lot of ways I kind of didn't know it could be any different because I didn't really set down roots.
Right.
As soon as I started to do that, we were in a plane again, right? We were moving again. So it was uncomfortable, but I don't think it wasn't crippling is what I'm saying. But one of the things you do, and I think this is just human nature, is you go to a new place and you try to assimilate, right? So you try to look the same and act the same and try to kind of become part
that.
Of that community. Right. And it's very difficult, right? And so that was always kind of tough for me. And it wasn't until literally probably when I turned 40, if I'm really honest, but late 30s to 40, that I finally was sort of like, you know, I don't have to do that anymore, right? Like, it's okay that I don't fit in. And there's no reason to change the person that I am just because my situation around me changes, right? At my core, there's no reason to try to adjust that. And I think, and as I grew up, I kind of realized that everybody does it, right? Like, it's not just people who travel and move, you know, internationally,
yeah.
But it's going to a new job or going to a new neighborhood or going to a new school or whatever else. A lot of times or even coming home. That's the other thing, right? You leave home, you start feeling like yourself, and then you come home for a holiday, right? And people expect you to be a certain way. Or, well, wait a minute, you weren't like that when you left home. So everybody is constantly, I think, trying to adjust who they are. And it can be a struggle. And so that was sort of my point. And that's you mentioned the tagline earlier, that the observations of a confident misfit. That's really what it came from. It was like, you know what, I'm cool with being a misfit. That's, you know, it's okay. I'm a good person. I try to be good to people.
Yeah.
And as long as that continues to be the case, it doesn't matter if I'm not exactly like what everybody expects me to be, if that makes sense.
Right. Now, have you ever been in a situation where you've actually been bullied or anything like that, or just you just knew that you were different and so forth? Because, you know, I have four boys, and
right.
Now they're 9, 11, 13, and 15, but, you know, one of them has been, not here, but one of the reasons why we moved here, one of our kids was bullied.
Right.
And
right.
Has that ever happened to you? Or,
sure.
If you don't want to go there, so that's fine.
I don't. I tend not to talk about it very much, but I kind of allude to it in the foreword of the book.
I gather, that's why I asked.
When I was 12, we moved to the United States, and that, of course, like I said, you know, teenage years and preteen years are kind of awkward anyway. But I kind of had a bit of a tough time of it, that move, that particular move. But what was interesting is it wasn't really from the students. I mean, I had a couple of people who called me names, but it wasn't really a big deal. I just kind of ignored them, and eventually they kind of went away. But I had a teacher who was very difficult. It was the late 70s.
Oh, yeah.
People weren't nearly as enlightened then
yeah.
as they are now, which is a frightening thing to think of if you think of that.
they still aren't, but it's okay.
Exactly. But I had one teacher who was constantly calling me names because we were living in a very homogenous neighborhood, and I was literally one of maybe two or three black kids in the whole school, let alone in my class, and she was not a very pleasant person. So I definitely dealt with that for sure.
I love this book because I think I have this theory, and whether it's right or wrong, I have no idea, but I think everybody experiences bullying at some point in their life. I don't care who you are. I think everybody goes through it.
I tend to agree. And the other thing that I think is,
whether
because
bullying
obviously
or not,
it's
know,
been,
but,
Yeah, and it's been in the news, obviously, a lot recently. And yeah. The thing that kind of, I mean, this is probably going off tangent, but the thing that kind of alarms me, I think, is that there's so much of our entertainment now that's, you know, on television or whatever, that is really kind of based around bullying, from as far as I can tell. There's videos where people get candid videos and they're, you know, do something that's humiliating and we yeah. laugh at that on television, or, you know, we're,
it and it goes
yeah, or there's reality shows where people who are sort of fringe society and we mock and I think it's got to be really tough, I think, for kids growing up now to kind of tell the difference between bullying and entertainment, to be honest with you. And so I think, you know, we can sit there and tell our kids, okay, we don't want you bullying, we don't want you mocking, yet television is telling us, oh, but the people are making tons of money by mocking. And you know, and so to me, it's a really tough thing to teach nowadays. In my house, we're in a really strict media diet, but my daughter is very young, you know, and then it worries me that when she's older, you know, how do we navigate that? You know, it's tough right now. Yeah,
we are. It is tough. I'll tell you, with the kids, you know, with the four boys and stuff, where we are seeing it a lot is in the social media and on Facebook and so forth. And you know, we've even had our kids offend other kids, and it wasn't anything our kids have done on purpose or anything. But you know, we've had parents call and say, you know, they really need to erase that comment and apologize, or you know, it's happened to our kids. So it's, that's pretty prevalent. And then the other thing you see it is sort of sometems in the video games and stuff that they play.
Sure.
You know, I don't know. There's no right or wrong answer. But I definitely, why I really just love your book, back to your book, is because, you know, you really are leading the way with teaching people to respect one another and to respect each other's differences and so forth. If you just go down the table of contents of your book, individuality, spirituality, imperfection, anxiety, heartbreak, language, adventure, and agelessness, every one of those things are, you know, how you are as a person.
Sure.
And
I mean, and
I
obviously that's not an exhaustive list. There's lots of things.
No.
Like, for example, one thing that I was going to tackle and then decided not to, was race, right? Like, race is a very easy way to kind of identify somebody as different, right? But I decided actually that, and I don't know if it's because, you know, like I said, I come from a very multiracial, multicultural background,
right,
that it didn't necessarily needed to be overtly talked about, right? That so, certainly I talk about some of the stuff I dealt with coming in as an immigrant and looking different from other people. There are portraits of people in the book who talk about their being different in their community. So it's kind of throughout the book, but I found it wasn't necessary to do an entire chapter on it necessarily, because it is just sort of a part, you know, a wash of people that are through the book that end up mentioning it. But yeah, I mean, the thing you mentioned something about, you know, teaching people to respect. I would even go one further. Obviously, I think you should respect people because they're different. But selfishly, I think it's amazing what you can learn from people who are different. And so it's not just
about, you're
different and I respect you, but, oh, you're different and I really want to get to know you. Because I think that by getting to know you, I'm going to grow as a human being, and I'm going to change my perspective, and I'm going to become a bigger, more well-rounded, more appreciative, for my own education, it's good for me to learn about you and about your differences. So, yeah, respect, I think, is sort of the baseline, frankly. You know, I think it should go even further. It should be, I don't want to say celebrated, but I think that there should be sort of an eagerness to learn, and an eagerness to learn more about people who are different from you, for selfish reasons, I think.
Yeah. And
you know?
and I was quite selfish on this call, quite frankly. I'm just like, I want to know about you. I don't know you. I've never met anybody from Trinidad. I've never talked to anybody from Trinidad before. And I am just absolutely, you put it very well, eager to learn and share with the world who you are, where you grew up, what you did, how you did that. I mean, I freaked out just moving from Iowa to Minnesota.
Sure.
I mean, I went from walking through cornfields to school to moving to this Minneapolis was huge to me.
Sure.
We'd go
right.
and visit my grandparents there, but they had parking ramps and parking lots and skyscrapers and all this stuff. And I mean, I arrived in Minnesota in my early 20s, and I thought, you know, I have lived. You know?
Right. Sure.
Very
right.
Funny.
And of course, I felt that, you know, even. I mean, when I was, like I said, I moved back and forth internationally constantly. And then when I was an adult in my 30s, I had an opportunity to move to London. And I quite myopically thought, oh, I've got this. This is no big deal. It's a big city. I've lived in big cities before. It's England. They speak the language, right? And Trinidad used to be an English colony, so there's a lot of English culture in Trinidad. So I know this. And I got there, and I was completely smacked down. I was like, oh, you don't know anything, right? So, I mean, I think it's, and here I was thinking, I'm just so worldly. I've traveled everywhere, and I've lived everywhere, and I'm no big deal. And I got to London, and I was like, oh, I really know nothing. And it took, a good 6 or 7 months before I finally sort of felt comfortable and got on my feet and was navigating this new experience in a way that was, that felt comfortable for me. I mean, I did well. I ended up marrying a Brit, you say it was just from Minnesota, from Iowa to Minnesota. I think I would not discount that is what I'm saying. I think any move can be very, anything moving from the familiar can be incredibly eye-opening. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, now I'm 41, almost 42, and I view most things now not fear-based at all. I view most things now as opportunities for growth and change and teaching my kids new things. And, we're excited for the things that, where the kids go to college or what they do or what kind of jobs they have or who they marry or whatever. I think it's all just going to be fascinating.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Yeah. It sounds like you've got a great outlook. I wonder, actually, sometimes whether or not you have to come to that decision after you've lived a certain amount of life or if it's earlier. Like, I wish I had this outlook 15 years ago, right?
I did, too. I did not. I know I didn't. I know this is recent, maybe in the past, 5 or 6 years for me, where kind of like a light bulb kind of clicked, on-off switch almost, and there were a few things that happened to me where I went through a few things and I'm like, ooh, I don't like that, and I'm not doing that again.
Sure.
And I don't know, have you had some of those experiences where you're just like, oop, that's not right for me, and I'm going to go broader than that or bigger than that or
well, as you
like
talked,
that?
The first thing that came to mind was my first marriage. So.
That was what came to mind for me, too.
So I would say yes.
Oh, yeah. That's funny.
Sure. I mean, but I think everybody, I hope everybody does. And I think if, I would be a little skeptical of somebody who has never had that, to be honest.
Yeah.
I would, if somebody told me, oh, no, I've never, ever felt like what I was doing. I never questioned what I was doing, right? I never questioned the path I was taking. I would be concerned that that person might not be living fully yet.
Yeah.
Because I think even if you stay on the path, right? Like even if you decide, oh, no, I'm on the right path, I think to live fully you need to be challenged, right? I think there needs to be sort of a challenge to you. You need to go, wow, is this still right? Is this still okay? Is this still the person that I am? Is this life still the life I'm supposed to live? And definitely, I think, I think if you're lucky, then yeah, that happens. But I think it's always good for something to challenge you on that and go, yeah, but what if? Yeah, but what if? Yeah, but what if? And have you kind of really sort of go inside and be introspective about where you're going and then making your decision one way or the other, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. What the one thing I notice about you that you have, and whether you've always had it, I don't know, but you have a very good self-confidence about you now.
Thank you.
You do. And I think a lot of women, I was just talking about this a couple of days ago with another author on the show also about self-confidence. And self-confidence seems to be one of those hot buttons for women especially. I'm shocked about men also. I always thought men were just awesomely confident, and a lot of men aren't either. But what do you think are some of the things that help you be confident even when you're not confident? You know, even when you are scared, what helps you be confident?
Mm.
And work yourself back up. Because I have to do that sometimes.
Sure.
You know, I'm not going to lie. Before I got on this call, I had to take a deep breath and go, I'm interviewing her.
Oh, my God.
You know? I did. I did.
Oh,
and
please,
I said,
no.
We were out. No, seriously, we were out in the car, and I was with my husband, and we do something funny. We have a bowling thing that we do because my husband had both of his hips replaced, and so he's rehabbing with bowling. And I was talking to him when we were bowling, saying, you know, I'm interviewing somebody I really admire today, and I don't want to screw this up. This is a very important hour.
No, I'll have my husband call you, and he will take me down a peg in your mind so quickly.
Perfect. Perfect. You know,
you'll be like, oh, no,
you know,
no.
It means that, so to keep in mind that I'm speaking to somebody real and everything. But, you know, I really admire you and all the things that
you've
done. You're an inspiration to women, and you really are. And so I think everybody always assumes that people who are lawyers and authors and engineers and you've moved everywhere, you're just booming with confidence. Even sometimes with me, people say, oh, you must never have a self-confidence problem ever. And I laugh. And I think, no, we have to have pep talks.
Yeah.
So when you have to have that pep talk with yourself, what do you say?
Yeah. It's funny that you're asking me this question right now because I'm going through a little bit of my own crisis and looking in myself right now. So with motherhood, because there's nothing that will take you down like parenting, I think.
Oh, my gosh.
When you think that you're, like, totally awesome and then, you know, your kid does something completely unexpected and you're like, well, hang on. That wasn't supposed to happen. I think there's something, frankly, to Well, there's two things. I think there's two things. One is I think that you really have to work on getting comfortable with the person that you are at your core, right?
Mm-hmm.
At your core. And when I say core, I'm not talking about accomplishments that you've done or, you know, education that you've done or any. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what it is that you value as a person, right? What it is that lights you up. What are the things that really kind of turn you on? And really get comfortable with that, like because a lot of times those core values and the things that really kind of turn you on are sort of your guideposts for how you're going to go through your life, right? And so for me, I journal a lot, and I'm not talking about the blog. I mean, obviously I blog, but I do a lot of journaling where I just kind of brain dump every day, just what's going on in my head, and you know, and then I go back and I start to see, okay, these are the things that are really really important to me, and I can't sacrifice those, right? And so I think is imperative to start becoming confident, because when you start having this kind of core value talk with yourself about how, you know what, it is imperative for me, I love traveling, it lights me up, it's what I do, and I need to have that in my life, or I don't want to travel. Travel is not what I love. What I love is creating a home and being there and being attentive to my home 100 times, or whatever it is. Like, you know, if we're large, you know, cultivating friendships or just cultivating, you know, group of friendships or individual intimate friendships or whatever it is, and really kind of cultivating that. Because then when you sit there and you think, okay, you know what, I'm a person who I'm going to just really focus 100% on family, then maybe becoming the CEO of a company isn't as important, right? And really,
right,
all it takes for you in business is to be able to provide comfortably for your family, and there's no need for that. So then you don't start comparing yourself with other people, right? Like, oh, well, that person is my age and is CEO, and why am I not that? Well, because that's not what lights you up, right? So I think that's the first thing, is it's really important to do that. And then the second thing, honestly, is I am a big believer in fake it till you make it, right? And
I love it.
And it may sound sort of oppositional to what I just said, but my point would be that if you are comfortable in this type of situation, then if you're comfortable being the person who travels tons, that, and you happen to be going into a group of people who would never consider traveling, then fake yourself as somebody who is comfortable enough to be in that group because you know what your core values are, right?
Yeah.
And then you will be, right? And so I think that there's something like you get really in touch with what it is that you value, and then when you're put in situations where that's challenged, you pretend to be a person who's comfortable with it, right? Because you know you are.
Get more confident, yeah.
And then you'll get more confident.
And then you learn from that experience.
Sure, absolutely.
And it grows you for sure, yeah.
Absolutely. So I think that's part of it. And then, you know, there's other people, there's other things. I remember when I was a teenager, maybe even younger, I remember at that point it sort of became cool to poo-poo when people complimented you, right? So if somebody said, oh, you're very beautiful, you'd go, oh, I'm not, look at my face, oh, my gosh, look at my hair, you know. Then all of a sudden
that
it became cool to kind of talk yourself down, right? And whereas, you know, up until that point, if somebody had complimented me, my mother would say thank you, right? Say thank you. But then at some point, all of a sudden it switched on that I was supposed to go, oh, no, my gosh, look at my face, or, oh, can you notice I have a scar, or whatever. And I remember I was watching a talk show. I can't remember what talk show it was, but Candace Bergen was on it. And the person who was interviewing her started by saying, you are so beautiful, right, to her. And I remember she just smiled and said, thank you so much, right? And they went on. And I remember thinking, that was so graceful, right? And it was so caring of her to say it, because when you say, oh, gosh, I'm not, you're basically saying, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, right? Right. Oh, you gave me a compliment, but clearly you don't have good taste, right? You know, like, in a way, like, turning that.
That might be your idol.
Exactly.
Yeah, that might, exactly. And, you know, you just have no idea what somebody else's idea of perfection is. It's absolutely wild. You know, I have one friend who just never thinks highly of herself, ever, ever, ever. And she's always like, Elizabeth, all the things you do and all the stuff, I'm sitting here going, you know, you're my idol.
Sure. Sure, and that can become uncomfortable for you to hear, but imagine how the person who's sincerely telling you what they think about you would feel if you kept dismissing it. And so that was something that I started very early on. I decided, you know what, when people say nice things, I am going
take
to
them.
I'm going to thank them, and I'm going to do it with sincere gratitude, because what they're really saying is, I really like that part about you. And what a kind thing to say. And so the only kind thing you can do back is to thank that person as well, even if inside. And you start doing that enough, you start to think, well, maybe I'm not so bad, right? Like, you know, you start accepting them. You start to think, well, maybe I'm not so bad. Maybe I don't repel people, right? Like, you
know. Repel, people repelling on. So be the opposite, too, of somebody coming up to you and say, you know, you're awful or something.
Well, sure, right? But then you can also, when somebody does that, like if somebody is just cruel to you, I mean, you start to go, you know what, I've had enough people tell me that I'm good. I know what my core values are, and I know what I'm trying to stay true to, so I can put that in the box that it needs to be put in, right? But, a very, very, very dear friend of mine who writes about this stuff all the time, her name's Brené Brown, and she writes about, you know, sort of vulnerability and shame and that kind of thing. And one exercise that she always talks about is to make a list of the people in your life whose opinions really matter, right? These are the people who you could go to and know that you're not going to get any judgment, right? You could tell them your deepest soul, and they're not going to judge you, right? They love you that much. Mm-hmm. And it won't be a long list. It will probably be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people. And she says, write it down and keep it on you, right? And the reason that she says that list of people is because if somebody else other than those people say anything about you, you can remind yourself, you know what, that's fine, they're entitled to their own opinion, but that opinion is not allowed to shake me because these are the people that are on my list, right?
Mm-hmm,
and those are the people. And then if somebody who's on that list says something to you, then you can go, okay, that person said that to me, it stung, but I know their heart, and they would never say anything to hurt me because they're on my list, right?
Yeah.
And I trust them, so maybe there's some introspection there. Maybe I need to talk and go a little deeper on that. So so that would be the third thing I think I would do in order to develop, is sort of really know who your tribe is and really know who – I don't even like tribe because tribe sounds like a lot of people. I call it war council. These are the people who you'd go to war for and who go to war with you, right? Who's on your war council.
Cool.
Yeah.
Who's on your war council? I love
Who's on your war council, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I want to go back for 1 second. And
sure.
You know the core values? What if
yes.
you're a person, for example, that might not know that yet? What if you don't know? It changes, too, it seems like, from every 10 years or 5 years or something like that. It's like, oh, and now I love to cook.
Right.
Funny.
But, well, you know, I agree, and I think it's very hard, and frankly, I can tell you some of my core values, but I haven't even delved deep enough to know what they all are, frankly,
me
myself.
Either.
And
you were saying that, I'm like, I wonder wonder what mine are. I'm sitting here going, I don't know. I was going to say, can you tell me one of yours so I can kind of get a, you know, get a read on sort of what you're thinking as a core value maybe
sure.
for yourself.
So one of my core values is to really stop and appreciate beauty, right? That's something that's really, really important
yeah.
to me. And one that's close to related to that is to really try to be conscious to minimize how much ugly I put out in the world and really focus on putting out beautiful in
beauty.
The world. And that's particularly for because I'm a blogger and I use Twitter and stuff like that. And especially Twitter is really hard for me because Twitter is a very easy way to kind of, you know, dash off what's on your mind, right? Without kind of being circumspect, right? It feels, you know, with a blog, you can kind of edit and re-edit and make sure your language is right. But Twitter tends to be more reactionary for me. But it
yeah.
is something that I think is important to me. Is there's just so much other stuff out there that's ugly and hateful and mean-spirited. And honestly, I think some of the ugly is necessary. I think that, you know, if you look in the media, like I think the media has an obligation to show what's happening, and some of what's happening in the world is not pretty, right? So, but I'm a core value for me is I don't want to be a part of that, right? Like I think
that's
there's enough other people that
media.
Can... Right, you know, well, exactly. Like, I do have a presence in media now because of the blog and because of Twitter, and all of us do, right, because of Facebook pages and
sure.
stuff like that. And so for me, and that's, like I said, I'm not judging anybody else who feels that they want to be able to put that out there. I think there's places for all of it. But my core value is I don't want to be a person who adds to anything ugly. And so it means that even though I tend to be a very politically aware person, that I rarely talk about politics online. Because I don't want to do anything that polarizes. I don't want to say anything that offends, right? And so I would talk about it among my friends. But for me, my media presence is I'm not going to put that out there. So it's, you know, so that's sort of one core value. And I'll tell you one of the ways that I kind of came up with it. I did a lot of this work after I quit my job as a lawyer because I was a lawyer for so long. And
mm-hmm.
so I decided, okay, well, what am I going to do now, right? Like,
yeah.
All right, I'm not going to practice law, so what now? And I made a list of everything that I love to do. And I've written about this before. I made a list of everything that I love to do. Literally sat down for about an hour and a half, and made a list. And it was everything from photography to singing in the shower to
yeah.
reading aloud to my daughter to emptying out my handbag and organizing it and putting everything back in. Like, everything
yeah,
that I love
it.
To do.
Yeah.
And then I started trying to go in and go, well, why do I love that, right? So, well, okay, I love reading, but why do I love reading? Well, I love to see how authors turn a phrase, like how they use language to explain, you know. And so I'd add that to the list, right? Or, well, why do I love reading out loud to my daughter? Well, I love performing. I love being all the different characters for her. Like, that's fun for me to do that. So I put that down. And then I started looking for patterns. And for me, the pattern that emerged is I love speaking, I loved writing, and I love photography. I loved shooting, right? And I found
mm-hmm.
that those are three things. So those are three core values for me, or at least those are three things that really light me up. And then I started really kind of focusing my life and looking for opportunities to do all three. So that was a kind of a career way to do it. But by doing that, it kind of made it really clear to me what things were, what was important to me. And one of the things that I would not have necessarily thought of at the top of my head was blogging, right? I mean,
right.
I'd been blogging for so long, it was almost a habit more than it was something I thought about, oh, I can't wait to blog. But here I was doing it for 7 years without pay, so clearly I must like it, right?
Love it.
Like,
yeah.
like I must be doing it. So that ended
not
up on the list. So it allowed a lot of introspection that way. So.
Huh. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, because I think that is a lot of. I'm very interested to hear this because that's a lot of how Best Ever You was born.
Right.
Fascinating.
Go ahead,
yeah, just sitting down. You know, I had quit a fairly high profile career, and
right.
I had two children with me. Got divorced, moved from Minnesota to California, got remarried, had two more children, quit the job. And just for probably the past, I don't know, I've been home now for probably like 12 years almost, maybe 13 years, and trying to figure out what you're going to do with yourself when
yep.
you don't have that law degree or you didn't get that doctor degree. You know, you're not the
right.
physician you might have thought about being. It's like, what am I going to do? And I started out really early as a news anchor and a reporter. And that was, you know, how you were saying you love to, you know, you love photography and so forth. Well, I love news. I love the, not the news. I love TV.
Okay.
I absolutely love the mediums of TV and radio with a passion.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned very quickly, just like you just said, which is neat to hear it, because I thought I was like the only person in the world who thought it. I don't like politics very much, and I don't like reporting negative things.
Right.
I'm an extremely, extremely positive person like you are. And I only want to put stuff out into the universe that features people or promotes people or says something happy or positive and so forth. And so that's best ever you.
Right.
And
right.
That's why you're on the show, because I just was like, oh my gosh, I just love the vibe you give out.
Thank you.
And so
well,
it's
you know,
neat to hear the thinking behind it, because I mean I picked up on it right away and I'm like, oh, this is a cool person.
Oh,
she's just neat, and I'd love to hear your thought process.
And I think both of us, it sounds like, went through this. In a lot of ways, that these kind of huge life changes that have happened, right,
mm-hmm.
where you moved and your kids were born and stuff like that, like, in a lot of ways, they're really great, even if they don't feel great at the time, because they kind of
yeah.
they kind of necessitate that sort of introspection, right?
Mm-hmm.
It requires you to kind of do that to figure out what your next step is going to be. What I think is harder, honestly, is when you're humming along in your life, you know that you're not particularly happy, but you sit there and you think, well, it's not like I can quit my job because I've got a family to support, right? And so I need this job, or whatever else. Yeah, I hate that I go to an office every single day, but how else am I going to make a living? And so it's harder. Like in a lot of ways, I think like you get laid off or something like that. The blessing in that, if you can find one, is that you can go, okay, what's next? I get to create what's going to happen next. There's you have to be creative because there's no other choice, right?
Yeah.
And when you're humming along in your life, it's easy to feel like you don't have to be creative with it. And so I think it's really important to kind of do these. That's why I'm so passionate about the journaling and the list making and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that, because I think it's really important to kind of do a check with yourself to make sure that you're still doing what you want to do. And then if you're not, and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm in this job, and it's sucking my soul, and I now know these are the things that I really love to do, well, then maybe you can start thinking about, well, how can I add some of that love to my life? I may not be able to quit my job tomorrow, but how can I start adding something where maybe a transition will open up for me in 5 years or in 3 years or in a year or something like that, because I've started paying attention to this part that lights me up. And when you start to pay attention to that and those core values, people see it, right? And then they start to look to you for it, right?
Yep.
So, you know, I mean, I had no idea when I quit my job I was going to write a book at all, right? I didn't quit the job to write the book. I quit the job because I finally said enough. I can't do this anymore. But when I decided, you know what, I'm going to start focusing on these things that light me up, people see that and they go, oh, well, if you
absolutely.
Really love to do that and clearly that's what's lighting you up, here's an opportunity that will allow you to do that more and we'll pay you for it, right? Or whatever
exactly.
else. And things start to happen where you kind of go, oh, okay. And I've really become in the last 2 years to believe that we really, really have a choice in how we create our lives. And it may not move as fast as we'd like, but we do have that choice. And we can either sit in the current and let the current wash over us, or we can figure out how to navigate the current. And I think really sort of going inward and going, this is what really turns me on, is the way to do that. I really believe that wholeheartedly.
In your book, and I'm just going to tell people the websites and everything again, The Beauty of Different, and you can go to thebeautyofdifferent.com or chukalooks.com or karenwalren.com. These are all photographs that you took?
Yes.
Oh, wow. How did you learn to be such a great photographer?
You
got really neat pictures.
I did not take a course. No. I've never been self-taught. I mean, I've never been to a course. It's all self-taught.
Yeah.
You know, it's really funny because I had decide. I'm not. I had always grown up believing I was not artistic at all, right? And even to think of myself as artistic is a little like it's a little uncomfortable even now. Like I sit here and I think, Karen, you have a book with pictures you took in it. Clearly, there's evidence to suggest. But even to call myself that, you know, my background is in engineering and law, and I grew up. Sort of being told that that's where my talent was, is engineering or law. I loved mathematics. And so anytime I and I, you know, I'm the daughter of a PhD.
You're just
engineer.
Smart anyway, though. You can tell talking to you that every part of your brain works.
Oh, I'm glad I've given you that impression. Let's just but thank you. But I really was sort of like, you know, and so every time I try to do something artistic, I'm putting that in quotes. Anytime I tried to do something in artistic, I was sort of guided away from that.
Yeah.
Right. My father, who, like I said, he's a PhD engineer, who loved every minute of his career, and to this day has been retired for 10 years and still finds way to consult in order. You know, he really loved it. He actually came from a family that was not particularly well off. He's one of 9 kids, right? And and he sort of self-made, right? So he got to university on scholarships and he managed to get his education that way. And so I think in a lot of ways his thinking was, oh, that's cute, you want to do something artistic, but that doesn't pay. And you need to do something practical, right, that pays. Yeah. And sure, you can be an accountant or a doctor, but engineering is a great thing, right? So, you know, and so I was sort of guided into that. And so when I was a kid, I remember specifically asking my parents, I thought, you know what, I think photography might be kind of cool. And I remember saying I really would love a camera, like a real camera where I can switch lenses out and stuff like that. And I was probably 10 maybe at the time. And that Christmas, my dad got me, I mean, this was a long time ago, it was a Kodak Instamatic. I don't even know if people remember this, but it was a camera that looked almost like a cigarette case. Like it was just sort of a block, like a little block that you would kind of put this funny skinny roll of film in the back and take a photograph of it. And I remember opening it up, and I remember watching their faces because they were so excited and thinking, you're kidding. Like, this is really not the camera I had in mind. Because I was like, I was thinking Ansel Adams, right? Like I was going to be.
Oh, sure.
And so I was like, all right. Yeah. And so I kind of like shot a couple, but you can't really do a lot. You know, like they kind of think for you. And so I was like, well, no big deal. And I put it aside. And then years later, I was in my 20s. I befriended a friend, a guy who was a fashion photographer. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, I really would love to get a camera. And I said, would you help me choose one? And he did. And so I bought a secondhand camera, a Nikon, and I just loved it. I started shooting all the time. But it was film, and I never learned, because I never took a course, so I never learned how to process my own film. I never had a darkroom. I never knew any of that. And so I started shooting a lot, and at the time I was practicing law, and I was traveling a lot to South America. So I was traveling to Rio de Janeiro and Buenos Aires and Caracas and all these places, and I would always book an extra day to my trip to go shoot. And so I was doing that, and that was great. And then I moved to England, and of course, when you move to a new country, you don't know where everything is. So I had no idea where the photo labs were, and I was traveling a lot, so I didn't have time to go find where the photo labs were. So I just let it go until I met my husband, and then like our first Christmas together, he bought me a digital SLR, a digital camera with the lenses, and that sort of woke me back up into it again. So that was about 10 years ago, and I just shoot, and I shoot, and I kind of learn, and I do a little reading, and I experiment with the camera, and I ended up with this book. So long answer to your question, but that's kind of how it happened.
No, it's great. I'm just looking as you're talking, I'm listening and looking at some of the pictures, and it's hard to choose which one. Do you have a favorite in here?
I do, actually. I don't have the book actually right in front of me, but there's a photograph toward the end that has a dragonfly. It's a very close-up.
That's my favorite. Okay. I wondered if that
dragonfly was
your favorite.
I mean, yeah, I still go back to that one and go, damn, I'm good.
This is one of the reasons, you know what, I was just like, I got to talk to her. I got the book, and I'm like, how did she get all – I'm fascinated by dragonflies for some reason anyway. But
yeah.
It's neat how you got all the little the indents
that,
or whatever.
That was
whatever
so much about luck. I had a very patient dragonfly. My husband saw him, and he's like, come shoot this. I came outside, and he would fly. He would just like fly up 3 feet, and then he would land on that branch again, and I would shoot, and he'd fly up. I shot probably 100 photos of him. that day. That was my favorite. But
beautiful.
And it's funny, like, you know, I say that facetiously. Like, there are some photographs in there that I'm actually not particularly proud of. Like, I look at it and go, you know, that was an off day or stuff like that. But
it's
that
hard
one.
To shoot people. It's, you know, it's hard to get photographs of people. And what I really like about this too, you know, with people are so freaked out about having their picture taken. Mm-hmm. You know, erase every wrinkle and pimple and everything. And these people have not.
Yeah,
and
you're
so
right, because I won't.
See a book like this. Yeah, and I won't either. Even to this day, and I'm involved a little bit with pageants and so forth, which I'm growing out of quickly. I can see I've learned this time around, but I still love them and everything. But I'm growing out of them a little bit into more of an advisor thing. But everybody always wants every little imperfection erased out of their face, and I refuse to do it, and it makes me a misfit.
Yeah, no, I flat refuse, and people know that with me. Like, especially friends get really upset with me because they're like, "Karen, can you please?" And I'm like, "No, I'm not doing that." I, and that's not to say I don't use Photoshop. I definitely use Photoshop.
No, yeah,
but
amazing,
but my rule is I don't delete pixels, so I don't.
No.
I don't delete if it's there, it's there,
if
and
it's
so
there, it's there.
Yeah, and what's interesting is for the majority of the people who I shot for that in that book, I don't know, right? I actually had a call out
sure.
on my blog and said, "Come meet me, and let me shoot you." And people said, "Okay, fine, come on out." And what I loved about it is when I had finally shot all of the people that were in the book, and I had them up on my screen, like I had sort of the thumbnails of all of them up on my screen. And I remember thinking, people aren't going to believe that I didn't hire models for this book, right? Because I really do believe everybody is beautiful. Everybody
beautiful.
Is really, really stunning. And I have a friend who actually, it took me a long time before she would let me photograph her. And I tell her all the time, I said, if you've never had a good photograph of yourself, it's because the photographer wasn't looking. Like, that's the issue. It's not because of some flaw on your face. It's because somebody... for the person isn't looking, because you can always find beauty in faces. Faces are stunning. Faces are, it's like saying that flowers aren't beautiful. Like, you just can't. You know, they're beautiful. They're different, absolutely. But that difference is what is so intriguing about faces. So the faces mm-hmm. are my favorite things to shoot, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you said something also, and it was about how how as a child, you know, I have a joke with my husband, and it's at birth they gave him a choice to be a doctor or a lawyer, every single person in his family.
Right.
They're either doctors or lawyers. But he happens to be the most fascinating artist. He's fascinating to watch, and probably very similar to you where, you know, growing up nobody ever said, you know, you should draw or paint. They said, no, you should be a doctor or a lawyer. And
right.
We have this picture hanging up in our bedroom, and it's of this, I don't know how many elephants are in the picture, but he hand-drew it when he was about 9.
Mm.
And it looks like somebody his own age now drew the thing.
Wow.
And the kids never really realized it until the past 2 weeks. It just didn't dawn on them that Dad drew that. I don't know
oh, right.
why. I think we just assumed they knew it.
Right.
And fascination has erupted in the household that Dad can draw and paint these past 2 weeks. So I'm really interested to see how this will go, because he's really a neat artist, and he's sort of like, well, maybe I'll pick up the paintbrushes again and stuff like that.
Right.
So I say
well,
go for it.
What is interesting for me, like I said, my dad kind of, you know, led me into the engineering thing. When I realized I didn't like to be like engineering, I went to law because I thought my dad would not want me to do anything other than that.
Sure.
When he got my book, after he read the book, he called me and he said, "I'm so glad you're not making a living as a technical person anymore." And that was like the hugest compliment from him, because I always assumed that was the only acceptable thing in his mind that I could possibly do. And I think that's also something else. It's like when we sit here and we kind of internalize what we think our family wants or society wants, knowing inside what we might be capable of, you have to remember they're coming from a paradigm that they don't have all the information, right?
Right.
And that a lot of times if you are like, you know what, no, I'm going to stay true to this, this is what I'm going to do, all of a sudden their eyes are opened up and they're like, oh, well, you just never told, you know, you never let us see that part of you. I didn't know that existed, right? Like, that's the other thing, is that we, you know, we're so busy trying to make sure that we're fitting into a mold that we think other people, and our perception of what they want of us might be skewed, right?
Yeah, that happens a lot, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely it does. So I hope your husband becomes an incredibly prolific artist as a result.
Yeah, I hope he does too. I'm all excited because he's quite, you know, he's a very good lawyer and has been a lawyer for like, you know, eternity now. You know, he's 53 years old, so he's been doing this forever. And so very interesting to see him. He takes very good pictures too. That's one thing we both have in common that we love to do also is photography, and we're hoping for a better camera. We love cameras. And then gardening as well. So, yeah, just it's neat to be able to be creative, you know, and not have anybody say, oh, you're terrible at that, you know, or whatever.
Right.
So, well, we have only, believe it or not, 5 minutes more to talk.
Mm, that
and
went fast.
It did. And I hope you come on again. Sincerely, I you're the person in life I want to go travel with somewhere. Before I die, I'm going with you somewhere.
There you go. We'll put that on our life list, for sure.
Please put that on my bucket list. but with 4 minutes remaining, what would you like to talk about? What haven't I asked you that I should?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
There's got to be something
we've talked about,
completely missed.
Well, let's talk about Lifeless, because that's something I'm actually really passionate about now.
Mm-hmm.
And you called it a bucket list. I call them lifeless because I think bucket lists tend to be a bit pessimistic.
I do too.
You're kind of looking toward your death. And I say, why worry about that? Let's look about how we're going to live. And so I call them lifeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another thing that's really really good for that whole introspection thing, right, is to make a list of all the things that you want to do in your life. And I made one. It's 100 plus things that I want to do. And some of them are like sort of daredevil for me. Like one of them was ride in a hot air balloon, and I'm afraid of heights. Some of them were really easy. Like I never learned how to make a friendship bracelet, so I wanted to learn how to make a friendship bracelet and then teach my daughter. So there's some really easy stuff and really kind of wild, crazy kind of, you know, stuff, mm-hmm. like eat truffles at the top of the Eiffel Tower, you know, or whatever. And I think that I think it's a really great exercise, because I think all of us kind of have an idea in our heads of things we'd love to do, but we never write them down. And it's been amazing for me having them written down, how many opportunities have opened up because I wrote them down. Or you think about something you'd love to do and it's a fleeting thought and it's gone and so you never think of it again, like riding in a hot air balloon. I would have never, you know, thought of doing it, and then I was in a place where they had a hot air balloon company and I was like, oh, I'm there. And so I was in Park City, Utah in a hot air balloon, right, last year, and I was like, this is incredible. So I'm a big fan of life list as well. It sounds like you've got a bucket list or a life list as well.
Well, I don't necessarily call it I use bucket list because my son said something funny the other day about a bucket list, and it just kind of came out that way. But I also kind of use things I want to do, mm-hmm. things I want to achieve, and my list is endless. I mean, it's overwhelming. It's one of those overwhelming things. And I'm going to add to it after this call, I swear. But the one thing I've learned with that list, and the reason why I just put that out into the universe, is some things I kind of have learned to put my list and share it with others, because
absolutely.
I'm learning as a person that a lot of the things, unless somebody else knows that you want to do that, you can't achieve it on your own, or you're not connected the right way, or you don't know how to get there or do that. And so, for example, on my list is one thing I want to do, and I've always wanted to do this probably for the past 15 years of my life, is I've always wanted to be Larry King.
Excellent.
Isn't that the funniest thing? All I want to do is have this simple show just like this that is on TV, and it just interviews people from everywhere. That's all I want to do. But how do you do that? And it's funny, but if you don't put it out into the universe, like you want to do a hot air balloon or eat truffles, you don't know how to necessarily navigate to get there exactly on your own, and I find that people connect.
Absolutely. People go, oh, you want to do that? You know, I just happen to have work at a television show, and we're looking for somebody like that. Here's an opportunity, right? So
yeah, it's fascinating. And so we only have a minute left, but please come back on the show again. I think you could almost be a regular on here, and we could host this and do other things.
Oh, it'd be my honor. I loved it. It's so much fun being here.
Yeah, just a joy. So please, everyone, buy Karen's book. I love her book. It's The Beauty of Different. It's at thebeautyofdifferent.com, or you can visit Karen at karenwalron.com.
That's
or,
right.
What's your other one? Oh, chukalook.com. We didn't even get to talk about, which we will. We'll have you back on again.
Thank
and
you so much.
Yeah, please. And if there's any questions that you want to ask Karen, please go join our community at bestevercommunity.com and please ask. And I will forward those to Karen, or I don't know, Karen, if, I don't know how accessible you are, if people want to go to your blog and ask you. The radio show has lit up with callers. And we didn't take any callers on this particular show this time around, but maybe next time we could do that.
Awesome.
So, but thank you so much for being here, and I learned so much from you, and I'm sure our listeners did too. You're amazing,
Beth.
Thank
you so much. Thanks very
much. Thank you. So,
take care.
All right, have a wonderful day, and with 10 seconds, everybody needs to just go buy your book.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
Have a good day. All right, bye.
Bye.